From Islamic Finance News, the world's leading Islamic finance news provider, this is IFN Podcast.
Hello, everyone. Good afternoon. Such a pleasure to be here with an esteemed panel of expert speakers and such a wonderful audience present as well. Today we'll be discussing Malaysia as a center of excellence, in particular Malaysia as a center for innovative Islamic financial markets and structured finance products. It's going to be a very far-ranging discussion, and we're going to cover a number of themes, including some of the factors driving the growth of Islamic finance markets, some of the challenges that are being faced, structured finance products, in particular liquidity management tools available to financial institutions, and of what governments and regulators can do to promote the growth of Islamic finance ecosystems, and of course, sustainability and the challenges that greenwashing poses. So very broad, far-ranging discussions. We'll try and leave about 5 or 10 minutes at the end of our discussion for questions from the audience. All questions will be most welcomed. And before I turn to my fellow panelists, I'll just set the scene very quickly in terms of where we are today, in terms of the global Islamic finance market. So I think it's safe to say that Islamic finance market generally over the last few decades has been on a growth trajectory, and that trajectory continues. Market observers have seen 10% growth last year in the Islamic finance industry, while 10% growth is expected this year and next year, and that's largely fueled by exchange-traded funds and Sukuk issuances. Islamic finance assets at the moment are something about $2.3 trillion, and that's expected to grow to about $5 trillion in 2025. Sukuk issuances have been very buoyant. 2020-2021 saw record Sukuk issuances, record levels of Sukuk issuances. 2022 was a bit flat, and we're expecting the same in 2023, but still at very, very healthy levels. So if I can turn to my fellow panelists it's a question for all of my fellow panelists. If you had to identify the single most important factor influencing global Islamic finance markets today, what would it be? Perhaps I'll turn to you, Bashir, first.
Assalamu alaikum. Yeah, I think talking from the context of our experience in Dubai, I think this is a question you have asked. Is it regulatory guidance that is lacking? Or is it infrastructure? Or is it the ecosystem, the cost? But the single most thing that came up in our observation is the expertise. Yes, we have the Sharia consult, we have the Sharia framework, the Sharia governance, but at the implementation level, at the firm's level, in terms of compliance, internal audit, in terms of external review, what we notice is there's a little bit of lack of expertise. Yes, compliance, but there are there all the relevant stuff that we would expect to, the governance structure we would expect to see is there, but I don't think they really understand the nuances of Sharia. So when it comes to interpretation from the top, from the Sharia board, and the way it's being implemented right down to the to the customer level, whether it's marketing materials, whether client disclosures, and other kind of a customer, or the implementation of the Sharia's requirements in full, I think that's where they're lacking. For me, one of the real challenges is to have the necessary expertise developed. Now, it can be in two forms. One, you can have the formal institutional education, trying to produce graduates who are specialized in Islamic finance. And also the other way is to have this kind of forum on Islamic finance as active as possible in order to bring the practitioners up to date on some of the Sharia issues.
So you're calling for more IFN conferences?
Yes, that's
IFN. Perfect plug. Andrew's going to be so happy. that's brilliant. Thank you very much, Bashir. Doctor, can I turn to you for your views on that question?
Okay. Thank you very much, moderator. Actually, thank you very much for IFN inviting me for this as a panel for this time. And my view is that the single most important factor that influencing the global Islamic market today is the adherence to Islamic principle and also the Sharia compliant practice, right? As you know, this what we call that the Islamic finance is all about the based on the derived from Islamic law, which is prohibit in terms of certain activities, which is riba, zara, and also the investment in industries are considered unethical or harmful. I think in terms of the growing demand for the Sharia compliant financial product and services has significantly, what we call that, influenced the global Islamic market itself. This demand is driven by the increasing of Muslim population itself, and as well of the interest of the non-Muslim investors, right? And seeking these ethical and also the social responsibility investment option. I think to cater for this demand, in actual fact, right, the financial institution especially, right, they have been developed a wide range of the Sharia compliant products, including the Islamic banking, suku, Islamic mutual funds, takaful, and also this and also the takaful. This product is adhered to these guidelines and principles set by the Sharia scholar, ensuring the compliance with Islamic law. That's my thoughts on that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think you've actually hit on quite a few important topics there, which we'll discuss in a bit more detail later. But thank you very much for setting the scene there. Mikmal, can I turn to you for your views on the single most important factor influencing global Islamic finance?
Sorry, thanks, Elias. And again, I think happy to be here. I guess to me, one of the most single important factor for Islamic finance is definitely in terms of harmonization and standardization of our own Islamic finance contract. Imagine, I think, being in the Islamic banking industry and Islamic finance industry without having what I call one single common contract or one single common understandings and standards, I think it makes it very difficult really for us in the Islamic finance world really to grow the market. Because at the end of the day, we do know, I think when it comes to finance industry, I think it's all about interactions and transactions and relationship between two parties. So when we speak about harmonization and standardization, definitely it is a must, because I think in the past there was also a conversation when it comes to accounting standard and risk standard. I think it doesn't really talk to each other, and then they talk about in terms of the convergence of the standard between accounting and risk. And similarly, I think for us, when it comes to the Islamic finance industry, I think we have grown really to a certain extent. I think specifically in Malaysia, in terms of the share of the Islamic books, I think we are close to 50% as we speak. But then again, I think where we stand as of today, in terms of how we grow the market globally, I think that's why in terms of harmonization, it is really very important. Because at the end of the day, for us really to grow the capital markets, it's not really talking about ringgit issuances. At the end of the day, I think we need to have what I call a common understanding. Again, harmonization is very important. To the extent, basically, the two biggest Islamic market globally, i.e. the GCC, Middle East, and Southeast Asia, if we cannot facilitate really the flow of capital, hedging between two parties covering from these two different parts of the world, I think we are really in big trouble. So that's why at the end of the day, I think whatever that we have done in the past, I think it works well to bring us here. But of course, going forward, I think we need to be a bit more focused so that I think we can have what I call a one common standard for us to basically interact and have a transaction with each other. So again, yes, like what has been shared, I think we do have all the relevant players within the market globally in terms of pushing all this standardization agenda. But at the end of the day, I think it is more of a political will for each of the players in the Islamic finance industry, sometimes really to put ourselves down and see we want to be standardized in terms of how we do things so that I think we can develop a really a better market for Islamic finance. I'll probably stop there. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, Akmal. Mushtaq?
Thank you, Elias. Asalaamu Alaikum, everybody. I'm very honored to be here, and I love KL. So thank you very much for having me on this panel. So some excellent points already made by the panelists, almost stealing my answers, I think. Education, harmonization, ethical standards, all extremely important. From ICMA's point of view, we are a voluntary standard-setting body. We're also very interested in the health of the market. So my answer would be liquidity. And this is really coming from the perspective of the conventional market. So some of the previous panels have alluded to, if you're targeting the Islamic investor, or if you're targeting the more buy and hold investors, then maybe this is not as relevant. But if you're looking at the growth of the Islamic capital markets and integration into the overall capital markets, not just quote-unquote conventional versus Islamic, but all of them together, liquidity is extremely important in two ways. One is to the market makers themselves in terms of liquidity management, being able to have repo facilities, being eligible for collateral facilities, et cetera. Just being able to manage those and not having them stuck on your balance sheet. And then secondly, from the investor's point of view, from the asset manager's point of view, when we talk about liquidity, it's not just about trading volumes and bid-offer spreads, but ultimately it's the ability to sell an asset when you really need to, when there's a potential problem. And in that respect, my impression is that certainly the sukuk market and some of the other Islamic products are not quite as liquid as some other asset classes out there in the industry. So I'll stop there and we can explore these further. Thanks.
Thanks very much. I mean, certainly the liquidity issue is a theme that recurs in a number of different contexts and conversations. And actually, that brings me that's a very nice segue to one of my questions for you, Akmal. Do Southeast Asian Islamic financial institutions have access to liquidity management tools and products on par with conventional banks?
All right, I'll try to cover it, I think, more from the so-called Malaysian perspective. Before diving into that question, I think it's good to highlight, I do believe, I think, sometime in April or March this year, I think Bank Negara did issue a report in terms of the state of Islamic financial market report, where they did a bit of assessment in terms of the liquidity of Islamic instrument here in Malaysia. It's good to understand, in the case of Malaysia, I think we need to understand there basically what I call a duality in the market, where the Islamic market operates hand in hand or side by side with the conventional market. So if you were to look at the so-called instrument in terms of the so-called the Malaysian government securities, we have the bond and of course, the sukuk format itself. We know for a fact when it comes to the so-called the liquidity of MGS or rather the bond itself, I think it's a bit more liquid than the government investment issues because for the same reason, i.e. the instrument to facilitate the purchase of the instrument itself is very important. And secondly, in terms of the ability of the repo market to facilitate those particular transactions. So from that point forward, I think it's a point that was raised by Mushtaq earlier in terms of liquidity is very important. It does indeed basically really drive in terms of the acceptance of the so-called instrument itself, why a bond is preferred over a sukuk in the context of the Malaysian government securities. But then again, if you were to look a bit further, which really covered in the report, when it comes to the corporate sukuk issuances, I do understand, I think for a fact, actually more than 80% of the issuances is really in the sukuk format. Again, of course, in terms of the purpose, it's slightly different. I think when people go for the corporate sukuk, I think they could be looking for a better yield that's being offered versus what government securities can actually offer. I guess this is where basically it is really very important, specifically for the Islamic market, really to develop all the ancillary products. Again, repo market in Malaysia, specifically for the Islamic market, I think is really still in the nascent stage. There was a conversation where the CCM or collateralized commodity Murabba is supposed to be the format going forward, or should we really stick to the SBBA, of which I will bring back in terms of my point earlier. This is where harmonization and standardization is very important, because at the end of the day, when it comes to liquidity, we not only want to limit it really to the ringgit space, of course, when it comes to dollar space, it's also very important, right? So that's why harmonization is very important. I guess there's a push from central bank to have at least among the banking players in Malaysia, I think where we need to have some sort of a common contract of which we would want to use relief for the liquidity tool. And in the context of Malaysia, of course, we are blessed enough because of the size of the banking players, specifically the Islamic banking players in Malaysia, is considered significant. Like what I mentioned earlier, the share book is close to 50%. But I guess in terms of the development, specifically in Indonesia, post the mega merger of the Islamic window of the three largest government banks in Indonesia, I guess the demand really for liquidity product, I think, will increase sooner or later. And of course, with the spin-off requirement coming from Indonesia, I guess the focus for liquidity, specifically for Islamic instrument, I think will definitely be there. So I'll just stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Dato, I could see you wanted to add to that.
I think in terms of liquidity, I think it's just to share on my experience before, whereby I think in 2020, whereby is COVID-19 is there, right? A lot of central bank have been, you know, coming up with the product. For example, like Indonesia side, they have some coming out with the product, which is, you know, for repo, we call it Islamic repo, whereby, you know, for liquidity per se, right, each of the bank can use this kind of product to make sure that their liquidity is ample. In Malaysia, I think what Ikmal sharing is that it's a good sign. So during that time, I think Vanguard have done a good action whereby they are reducing SRR from, you know, 4% to 2%, which is having the market surplus about 30 billion ringgit in the market. Other than that, I think for internationally, I think the WLM product, WLM, which is they're issuing the short-term suku, which is, you know, normally about 3 months and 6 months tenor, is helped the global, for example, like from Middle East, from Asia, right, to have something that surplus liquidity to mop up their liquidity on a daily basis. Lah. So these are the things that I think some of the things, standardization is very important. For, the one that I can give example is the WLM Sukuk. I think we have to come up with more kind of, liquidity product, which is more innovation to make sure that globally will be accepted. And the standardization is very important. It's a key here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dato. I think touched on quite a few big... Oh, sorry. Here. Did you want to add to that? Okay. I think we've touched on quite a few big issues around harmonization, around sort of the roles that regulators and governments can play in the development of standardized taxonomies as well as products. Bashir, can I turn to you to talk to what regulatory frameworks you've seen being successful in the development and support of Islamic structured finance and capital markets?
Sure. I think I can speak on behalf of, again, Dubai, because we're operating in the national financial hub. One of the key things that we had to consider when we started putting out the framework is to make sure that we have a minimum harmonization. In other words, you know, if you're developing an international sukuk market, you have to find what is the default harmonization you have to have. And in doing so, you have to strike a balance between you have your own local, you know, requirements and needs and risk appetite, but at the same time, you have to align it with international benchmarking. So once you have that kind of regulatory framework, then the other important thing you need to consider is the cost of doing business in Dubai. How do you keep the cost in check? If you look at international issuance of Sukuk, the cost can be, it could be from 2%, of the total money that's raised, or maybe less, 1.5%, to all the way to maybe 6 or 7%, depending on who the issuer is, and whether the repeat issuer or standard issuer. So you have to look at the cost structure. Now, in other words, from the DFSA's perspective, we look at, you know, how much fees can we actually charge, how fast we can turn around. So that takes you to the efficiency as well. So it is important that you be able to turn around your applications for Sukuk in the as quick as possible. You know, if you're looking at the one of the best international benchmark, I think it's probably Dublin. Dublin can turn around the prospectuses in within 3 working days. So we have to ask ourselves what sort of processes we need and expertise we need in order to turn around a Sukuk documentation which is going out for international as fast as Dublin or even faster. So process is also important. And the other thing is also managing our expectation of our stakeholder, especially our senior management, because they have their own risk appetite. And so you have to really, kind of bring them up to speed in terms of the Sukuk market and then make sure their risk appetite is actually aligned with the market and the type of market we are seeing. Basically, if you see, for example, if you have a government issuer, a sovereign issuer coming to the market, so we should see, we should ask less information and the management should be a bit more comfortable that, it's a sovereign issuer, we have less exposure to the risk. So these are some of the infrastructure that you need to have in order to internationalize your bond market, or hence your Sukuk market. So I'll stop there for a moment.
It's the classic balance between being, providing a good framework, but not being too prescriptive, effectively allowing market participants to innovate and to develop and move things forward. So you're talking about stakeholders and market participants. Iqmal, can I turn to you as a person who's regularly dealing with regulators and increasing levels of regulation for your thoughts on what regulators can do to promote the Islamic finance ecosystems for participants like yourself?
Yeah, in terms of talking about the stakeholders, again, I think when it comes to the policymakers, I think it is really very important. And one of the key reasons to the success of the Islamic finance market here in Malaysia, let's just use in terms of the asset sizes as a measurement of success. Really, one of the single most important policy here in Malaysia is basically in terms of our two-tier Sharia governance framework. So we know for a fact, I think when it comes to the capital markets here in Malaysia and even the financial market here in Malaysia, one of the two most important big brothers here in Malaysia is definitely the Securities Commission and Bank Negara Malaysia. So what they have put in place by having this SSC, the Sharia Advisory Council, really at the BNM level to look into all the banking matters with regards to Sharia compliance. And of course, from SC perspective, they do have their own Sharia Advisory Council. I think these two are very, what I call the single most important factor in terms of having the right policy really to grow the market. And then basically regulators being one of the most important stakeholders in terms of their role, I think it is also very important, like what I mentioned earlier, whether these regulators can really work closely hand in hand really with the governments. Again, what is more important into the government, I think we've got to be very clear. I think under the current government, the Madani government, I think they really wanted to focus in terms of strengthening the investment, in terms of upskilling the human capital, and at the same time, enhancing and improving the so-called infrastructure, physically and even digitally as well. It is very important, really, for the stakeholders really to be really on the same page, and it's very rather refreshing, at least in terms of some of the mega trends that we have seen in the markets, specifically in terms of the push towards social finance. So that one is one. And secondly, the push really toward net zero. It is rather refreshing to see government really coming out with all this NETR, basically a clear policy where both the financial sector and corporate sector really can work hand in hand. But at the same time, it's also very important, of which our government of the day, I think, have taken a big step really to redefine the DNA of Islamic finance. I think there is a push. I think we have heard it at this multiple times in terms of moving from Sharia compliant to Sharia based. And earlier, Tan Sri Azman, I think, did speak about in terms of moving from halal to toyib. So again, in terms of basically redefining in terms of the role of the financial institutions and how we can work with the stakeholders where basically we also put their interests really at the forefront is very important, because at the end of the day, it's no longer about the profit. It can be about the purpose of which we would want to achieve, really, as a nation, and of course, really as global players as well.
Thank you very much. You touched upon another theme there around the link between ESG, sustainability financing, and Islamic financing, which I find very, very interesting. Obviously, there are a lot of synergies and overlaps between Islamic Sharia principles and Islamic financing and sustainability financing. Mushtaq, can I turn to you for your insights on what more you think might be needed for markets generally with regards to growing Islamic finance products that are sustainability linked?
Sure, great question. Well, I think one thing we don't necessarily need is additional ESG standards for sustainable Islamic products. Because one point I'd love to be able to reiterate and emphasize here is that when you look at the green bond principles, the social bond principles, sustainability-linked bond principles, the other guidance that has been facilitated by ICMA to develop the sustainable finance market, these principles, and you can go on the website and read them. They're very short, very clear, I think. You'll see that they are absolutely structure agnostic, and what that means is that the definition of what makes a green bond, what constitutes a green or social bond, it doesn't matter whether it's a conventional vanilla bond or whether it's a sukuk or whether it's an ABS or anything like that. These pillars of the principles, which are namely the use of proceeds, the management of the proceeds, ongoing reporting, impact reporting, these are all independent of the actual structure. Now, let me also address the point about the overlap between Islamic finance and ESG finance or sustainable bonds. Now, fortunately, I think that when people say Islamic finance is naturally more amenable to sustainability, I personally believe that that is correct. However, there are some important distinctions between Islamic finance as traditionally understood and sustainable finance as is currently practiced in today's market. Let me highlight a couple of those differences. So first of all, I think most Islamic products take a negative screening approach, right? Do no harm approach. And this, of course, is now part of sustainable finance, actually a very recent innovation. But generally speaking, sustainable finance, when you look at green bonds, it talks about the actual use of the proceeds and using them for projects that are environmentally or socially beneficial, or in the case of sustainability-linked bonds, having targets at a corporate level to improve specific environmental or social goals. So it's not about avoiding harm, it's more about doing good. I won't get into the details about do no significant harm as part of various taxonomies and so forth. That's another discussion. The second, I think, important distinction is that with sustainable finance, it's really not as much about the ethical aspects of the investment in terms of the definition of green bonds and social bonds. It's really more about the process, about the disclosure that's involved. So when you talk about a sustainable bond, of course it has to be green and so forth, but there are also technical requirements involved in that determination. And these have been developed recently, over the last 10 years, by the industry in order to ensure credibility and avoid greenwashing, which I think we'll get to in just a second.
Absolutely. And before we get to greenwashing, I wanted to ask you, Ikmal, in terms of sustainability-linked products, are you seeing momentum gathering?
I guess in terms of the demand for really sustainability-linked product or sustainable product, the demand is really definitely there. I guess in the past, or at least over the last couple of years, I think people has been asking really for the product because it's quite common for someone looking for all this sustainability-linked product. I think there's always a benefit around it other than the ulterior motive, but at the same time, you will be able to enjoy certain amount of rebate, I think, in terms of their so-called funding costs. The demand, it is really definitely there, but at the end of the day, I think we try to really make it a norm. I guess in the context of CIMB, right, when we refresh our commitment from 60 billion to 100 billion, a lot of people is really asking a question, hey, Ikmal, you're committing to 100 billion, why can't you give me about 1 billion? So I think we know for a fact, at least in terms of the demand for the product, it is really definitely there. And when it comes to all this accessibility link product, I guess the underlying motive is really to put a certain accessible performance target really on the client. Because sometimes this client, I think they may not have a really underlying project of which they will need to finance, but I think there are certain things of which they can really improve where they cannot really be green. But this is where basically we would really put in place certain performance target of which they will need to achieve. Again, when it comes to this particular space, like what I say, the demand is really definitely there. I guess in the past, to give out rebate, I think is kind of common, but I guess over the years, I think as they understand a bit more why they are doing this is really eventually for their own good as well. So that's why the demand will continue to grow, and we as a bank, I think we will continue to facilitate for this kind of transaction. And I guess going forward now, the question is that whether we will be able to hit that 100 billion, I think by next year, I think that one, again, something that we are really looking forward to. But what I can say, I guess the momentum is really started to shift gear. And I guess really with the latest announcement from really for the government, when it comes to the so-called transition financing, right? If you were to look in terms of the investment of which we will require between today until 2050, we will need roughly about 1.2 trillion ringgit. And again, I think in terms of basically finding this so-called investment is very important. And really for a bank like us, where basically we're more of an intermediary in terms of facilitating this project, that's why we do believe the demand is definitely there.
The demand's definitely there, as you say. You mentioned you're finding it challenging potentially to find projects to finance, you know, to finance into in a sustainable or green manner. What do you think are some of the challenges around that and why that might be?
At least one thing that we do observe is that I think we as a bank, I guess you probably heard really in the news, I think we do issue a few what I call sustainable or accessibility link product. I think in really on the retail side, we do have what I call EcoSave I product, which is a savings product where we are contributing about 20 basis points, really on the balance of which you really put with the bank really towards what I call environmental causes. So that is really on the retail side. And if you were to look on the non-retail side, we do have on the shelf what I call the sustainable term investment account product, where the proceeds that we raise from this particular instrument will be channeled towards this sustainable cause. And at the same time also, we as a bank, we do issue some of this funding instrument really in the what I call in sustainable form. Because at the end of the day, we really try to avoid any semblance of greenwashing. So there's a bit of competition in terms of really generating all the sustainable assets, because at the end of the day, for a fact, the demand is really there. There's only a certain amount of what I call sustainable instrument we can issue, of which really driven by the size of our own assets. So that's why it's very important, really from the origination side, really to make sure the flow of all these green and sustainable assets will continue to be there.
Yeah. You mentioned that term again, greenwashing. it certainly seems to be of major concern, I think, to all. We were speaking earlier about this issue as well, and certainly a concern from all of our different perspectives and from, you know, where we're all sitting. So perhaps I can turn to you.
Sorry. Just to share in terms of the asset management perspective, I think some of the issue that I can foresee now is among of the investor, right? We can see some of them is not really aware about this. What is the benefit of the, you know, sustainability finance, right? So these are the things that I think as a player, I think we need to do something whereby, you know, we have to do something like a showcase of the investment opportunity. For example, what is the benefit of when you invest in this kind of, you know, fund, right? So the other things that, you know, what we should do probably that, you know, the important thing, some of the issue that arises probably is there is a lacking of data itself, right? So not many, because I think some of them, you know, the sustainability agenda, probably some of the banks, you know, is starting quite late, right? Something like 2017, 2018, right? So lacking of data, that is the main issue, you know. So to have, at the end of the day, you know, the investor is still looking at the, you know, whether the sustainability, you know, fund can give a good return for them in the future. So these are the things that the market player need to be sorting out. Some of the issue that I highlighted just now. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. And I think certainly some concerns around greenwashing strike to the credibility of the assets that claim to be green and sustainable. Perhaps I can turn to you, Mushtaq.
All right. Okay, very good. Yes, this is a very complex problem, and certainly one that is something we very much have to consider in sustainable finance, not just because it threatens the growth of the industry, but also because it's something that regulators are paying a lot of attention to nowadays, and we're very aware of that. So what I can try to do is encapsulate my thinking and try to simplify this, which is a very complex problem. When I see in the market accusations of greenwashing or cases that are labeled as greenwashing, I think it's very important to distinguish the different ways in which people are using that word. So there are certainly cases of outright misrepresentation or omission of material facts. This is basically securities fraud. And we've seen this for centuries, right? So all we're talking about here is we're talking about claims being made in documentation that about the sustainability of a product or about the ESG credentials or qualifications or certification of a particular investment, which don't turn out to be true. Now, we have, of course, seen most of the cases involved in retail products in fund labeling, for example. But I have to say, and we're not just tooting our horn here at ICMA, that in the sustainable bond markets, you haven't seen any real misrepresentation. And that's not because we're all great people. It's more because there are lots of checks and balances in the product, in the process of issuing a green bond from the banks, the underwriters, the issuers, the external reviewers, to prevent that sort of thing from happening and the reputational damage. Now, the second category, which I think is a bit trickier, is where there's a representation of kind of ESG credentials or some sort of very socially or environmentally beneficial product or actions by a company or by a bank that are inconsistent with their overall strategy. So there's a potential whiff of hypocrisy here. It's not lying, but it's slightly misrepresenting, and it doesn't quite feel right, right? And I think this is much more vulnerable to greenwashing accusations. And this is sometimes what you're seeing in the market, where a company comes out and says, okay, we're saving plastic straws, you know, therefore we're environmental. Or maybe they're using carbon credits and their ESG strategy overall is not as positive. So these kinds of cases, in the case of the capital markets, this is actually something that ICMA is addressing head on. And it's very relevant to many of the issuers in Malaysia and GCC because they are not inherently green companies. And so when they issue a green bond, they issue a sustainable instrument, they are potentially open to accusations that they are trying to appear greener than they are when their overall corporate strategy or actions are not that green. And so ICMA has issued guidance on transition finance, which is basically designed to help issuers design, put together a very ambitious transition strategy that's consistent with the Paris Agreement and have the adequate disclosure, have the adequate science-based targets to be able to build their credibility in the market and combat those potential accusations of hypocrisy. Now, the third category where we hear accusations of greenwashing is, I think, the one that's a little bit unfair, is where there's just a reasonable disagreement about what is green enough, about what is ambitious enough. So we've certainly seen cases in Asia where issuers in very good faith have been in compliance with their national taxonomies or regulations, that have full disclosure in place, that are aligned with the Green Bond Principles and the process and disclosure requirements, and yet face accusations of greenwashing because what the use of proceeds are for them or the targets of their sustainability-linked bond, for example, are just simply not considered sustainable enough, right? And this is I think, a difference in interpretation, potentially in judgment, and reasonable people can differ. And you can say they're wrong, you can say they're not ambitious enough, but I don't think that implies something as serious as greenwashing, which implies some sort of bad faith.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's because the taxonomies are quite different in different jurisdictions. Investors in the US or Europe might have a very different idea as to what sustainability means, or what a green bond or green sukuk would mean compared to, for example, Indonesia or Malaysia. So there's not necessarily an alignment of those taxonomies across jurisdictions. And it'd be difficult to see where those could align completely because they're very different in different places of the progress in their story. So.
Well, I think you can take an optimistic or a pessimistic view on this, right? It really depends on your kind of angle, your mood for the day, perhaps what you ate for breakfast. Because you know, if you look at say, we've looked at taxonomies around the world, and if you just compare them kind of side by side, I'm just kind of throwing out a number here, but basically 80-90% of taxonomies are exactly the same. I mean, we all broadly agree on what is green. We all broadly agree on what is socially beneficial. So I think sometimes I feel like there's a bit of an overemphasis on our differences, whereas in reality, we all know pretty well what is green. Now, there is that 10 to 20% where there is differences. And that's where a lot of the controversies occur. That's where a lot of political considerations come into play, where economic considerations come into play. And I think it is an issue, but I don't think that the differences of opinion on carbon-related technologies, nuclear, transition projects, these sorts of things, just because there's disagreement globally about whether these are green enough, that doesn't mean that they cannot necessarily be the topic or the subject or the target of sustainable instruments. And just because there may be disagreement among investors and stakeholders about what is green enough, there may still be a very significant investor base for issuances or for environmental technologies where there may not be global agreement on the environmental credentials of them.
I like the optimistic viewpoint. So that's...
Well, I try. I mean, I'm a little bit pessimistic about the overall state of the planet, but I try to be a bit optimistic here.
Thanks, Mishtak. Bashir, can I turn to you for your thoughts as from the regulatory point of view around greenwashing, your concerns around it, and what you think are some of the things that we can do from a regulatory perspective?
Yeah, it's an important topic. It's in the minds of most of the regulators around. Yes, obviously, the greenwashing definition is something that we struggle. But what we are doing right now is to defer to the ISCO's definition on what greenwashing is. This really is about it's about whether you misrepresent anything about sustainability features of your practices, or with regards to any investment product, sustainability features of an investment product. So this broadly, so if there's any misrepresentation, either an inappropriate use of a term or a blatant deception put out there. So this, it's very difficult to actually determine what greenwashing is. However, what we are seeing is that a lot of disclosures, international issuers, whether it's Sukuk or whether it's bond issuers, they, given the fact that they may inadvertently run into the risk of greenwashing, they do put up some sort of a risk factors. The amount that has been raised may or may not necessarily be used for ESG related objective. And then they leave it to the investors to decide whether they want to invest in this product. And then secondly, how they cover themselves is, is also to make sure that they have a proper, you know, internal adequate systems and controls in order to make sure that they can track the usages for the proceeds for you know, ESG label product or a sustainability label product. Then you know, and also keeping the market informed, publishing you know, annual reports and say that how the money has been used. If they didn't use it, what were the reasons? And to get a third party to actually verify. So these are some of the good you know, practices in order to mitigate the risk of greenwashing that we are seeing happening in our market. But having said that, if these kind of you know, attributes are missing, there's a clear, there's a, you know, it's inclined towards a greenwashing already and it's an offense. Then we start looking at, did you actually misrepresent? And so what are the applicable law that, you know, that relevant, that's relevant? Did you, you know, it was there some sort of, you know, a con, did you not, did you lie about the contents of the prospectus? Or you know, you failed to, you know, actually use the proceeds for what is intended to be without all this additional risk factors. So yes, we are monitoring the space. Unfortunately, we don't have a specific regulatory framework on that simply because you know, one of the reasons is that the taxonomy is very complex and it's always evolving. And as you said, you know, we have been talking, everybody is aware that this is a greenwashing. It really hinges on what ultimately the definition is going to be about in a particular product, ESG product.
I'm going to put you on the spot with one question. Should arrangers be allowed to rely on those risk factors to absolve themselves of responsibility when it comes to, the, for example, the use of proceeds?
Should the issuers be
should the arrangers be allowed to rely on those
arrangers.
Risks? Yeah, arrangers and issuers be allowed to rely on those risk factors?
It's
a tough question.
It is a difficult question. I understand. I mean, it is all you're part of the same, you know, the scheme. But what ultimately, from a legal from a regulatory perspective, the liability is on the issuer. Right. So. If the lead arranger, whoever else, or even the third party, are in cahoot,
right,
then it's a question of you know, taking a, you know, a more a wider enforceable enforcement action. But ultimately, it is on the issuer who is principally liable for, you know, what they set out in the prospectus or failing to keep the market continuously informed.
Mishak, I think I saw you.
No, I was just laughing because you're just asking like a true lawyer. You know? Yeah, well, ask the regulator. But I just wanted to add quickly that, you know, it's not just, of course, greenwashing is now a regulatory concern. That does vary by jurisdiction, but it's fair to say that all regulators are looking at it. But I think at least in the capital markets, and as I say this again in a positive, optimistic way, There are real reputational concerns, and again, giving a good spin on this, this it actually ensures the quality. So it's not just about the risk factors. I think that's important, but ultimately, in my personal experience, in speaking with issuers and speaking with underwriters, their chief concern is not, you know, are we going to get caught out by the risk factors and not relying on those? Is it? It's more, are we going to be are we going to have negative press? You know, are we going to have investors complaining about us? Are we going to have reputational damage in terms of our ESG credentials? Now, the negative side of this is that if those concerns become too vague or too restrictive, then that can prevent further issuance and growth of the market. And I have to say, unfortunately, we have seen a little bit of that, particularly in Asia, over the last couple of years. It's not necessarily that issuers will suddenly say, okay, we're not going to be doing sustainable issuance. But when you have a conversation with a, let's say, a corporate in Asia, and I've spoken with many of them over the years, you're generally speaking with the CFO or the treasurer, and they'll ask you all the normal questions about how much money is this going to save me, how much is it going to cost, you go through that. And usually, there is sometimes there's a greenium, sometimes there's a benefit in funding, but normally it's not hugely significant. And I think there's still some debate about the extent to that, especially for new issuers. So at the very least, there's going to be some additional work, hassle, potentially cost involved in a sustainable issuance. And if there is a slight uptick in the risk of this going badly in terms of reputation, because part of the supposed benefit is a reputational benefit, right? So if there's some counter winds to that, then that is going to affect the decision of a company to make the initial effort to develop a framework for sustainability and to take those first steps to invest the resource, both human resource and cost, to put together sustainable issuance.
Thanks, Mushtaq. I think we've just got I think we're 1 minute over, but I'm not sure if, I think we might have time for maybe one question from, I see a hand raised. Oh, sorry. We got a microphone. You? Please.
Assalamu alaikum, my name is Sohaimi. Actually, I've been waiting for this opportunity to ask questions, and finally I got it. Thank you very much. Now, I was looking at the topic, yeah, and we are talking about innovation. So, well and good, we have heard many innovative stories and what banks have done, and basically I will consider that as what you have innovated within the bounds of commercial banking. Mainstream banking. Well, yeah, you got to do it. But if you talk about real innovation, it has to be something different, something disruptive. And this one is the real thing that we should do, that we should move. It's like banking and financial must move out. Okay? BBI has not been working that well either. Right? So what I'm proposing, okay, is a total spin-off of Islamic banks from the mainstream banking parents. Why this is good, okay, is just like digital banking. If digital banking can stand by itself, having its own set of regulations per se, it may overlap with existing ones, no problem. So must be Islamic banking. In the case of Malaysia, they are too matured. I've been around here for 15 or more years, and we're still talking about the same issues time and time again. Right? So I think Bank Negara and you guys must really think about spinning this off, making an independent unit, and why also is for the good of EPF. Remember, EPF, our Islamic dividends are not that well. Why? Because large part of the banking sector returns are not there. So if you do that, then you will also help EPF. For the many Muslims here. So now, with that, I also want to add, if you hear greenwashing, we can also say Sharia washing. Okay? Now, please move from that part of it. Okay, thank you very much. Actually, this issue is not meant for the whole lot of you here. Could have been for one before, and could even be for the first session itself, where we will see, where we have the Secretary General of IFSB around on stage, but I'm sorry. But anyway, this is my view. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That is definitely a view that's, I think, echoed by quite a few people. So thank you for sharing that. I'm not sure there's a question there, but I know Ikmal's very eager to answer that.
Yeah, thanks for that. I wouldn't call it more of a question, but again, I think I do understand. I think eventually, in terms of the end state, where we want to be. And I think we spoke about in terms of being Sharia based instead of Sharia compliant and how to move from halal to Taib. Again, I think for a bank, I think, yes, we work really in a regulated market. I think we do have multiple stakeholders. As of today, really on the liability side, basically we are dealing with depositors. There's a certain amount of risk of which they really entrusted with the banks. And in terms of our day-to-day activities, I think we got to be very clear in terms of what is our actual mandate? Because at the end of the day, in general, I think we are more behaving more like an intermediary. But I do hear you, because at the end of the day, I think it's all now not just about providing funding or doing what I call a capital allocation. Yes, I think there are basically no better time really to move towards something that's really better. I mean, as of today, I think even from Bank Negara perspective, they have come forward in terms of the framework, specifically on the investment account. basically is differentiating itself really from the normal deposits. And we do hear about in terms of blended finance as well. So that's why I think as of today, it's quite common if you were to see some of the banks here in Malaysia in terms of their role going beyond generating profit. That's where basically we try to utilize as much what I call catalytic fund as much as possible, either to amplify really good, really towards the bigger society. We do hear basic conversation whether we can use Zakat fund really to fund some of the petty traders, small-time entrepreneurs here in Malaysia. And we heard about in terms of all this IT card program here in Malaysia, where we try to give some sort of grant really for all these micro entrepreneurs really to put themselves out there. And of course, going forward, then they probably can deal with bank, I think, more on a commercial basis. Yes, you are right. I think at the end of the day, in terms of the ultimate purpose really of Islamic finance, at the end of the day, it's not really try to enrich really only the shareholders, but of course, I think all the key stakeholders. Again, I think it is really a journey. I think bank has started to shift in terms of their behavior on what they can really do really to help really the bigger society. I'll just stop there in case there's anyone else who would want to chip in. Yep.
Thank you very much. We were actually discussing that very thing earlier and some of the challenges that you face from, for example, spinning off in the direction that gentleman mentioned. Andrew, you're up here. I think that's my time.
Thank you for listening. For more discussions on the Islamic finance industry, log on to www.islamicfinancenews.com. You can also listen to IFN Podcast on your favorite platforms, including iTunes and Spotify.